Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Good afternoon from Florida Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the October 9th, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, welcome aboard, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. If you happen to be listening for the first time or have just stumbled upon us by scanning the dial, then you should know this is a one-hour radio show about our nation's space program, and virtually no space-related topics are off-limits. And if you have ever wondered if you will ever get a chance to fly in space yourself, then today's edition of Space Talk in particular is one that you're going to want to stick around for, as space tourism is going to be our main topic of the day. But first, I do want to talk about a few things that have been happening here the past couple of weeks. And I do want to start by acknowledging the fact that the big layoffs associated with the end of the space shuttle program have begun here at the Kennedy Space Center and certainly around the nation. I don't want to dwell on the numbers or debate right now anyway the reasons why this is all happening. I have no stones to throw at anyone over the news. I do just want to publicly acknowledge the loss in and to our community. I want to say thank you to those who have worked so hard to make so many of our dreams come true these many years, and wish everyone who will be personally affected by these layoffs all the best. For what it's worth, I do happen to be a Christian, and my faith and my God tells me that he has a plan for all of us. We may not understand that plan, and it might not be the one we had hoped for ourselves, but I strongly believe in the idea that when God closes one door, he opens another. I have been laid off twice in my career, and in both cases, I wound up in a better place for me and my family than I was before. So there is always hope for all of us as we live through this time together. And we will see additional layoffs during the next year or so. And I know that each time that happens, it will be sad. But I do want you to know I don't intend to keep a running scorecard on this program and make comments every time another round takes place. I don't want anyone to think just because I don't talk about it, I don't care. I do, and this affects us all very deeply. But I do want this show to remain upbeat and positive about our future in space, because I do believe that the future in space is upbeat and positive, and we are going to see some very remarkable things happen from our space coast here during the coming years. So with that said, and on a much, much lighter note, there have already been some remarkable things to see at the Kennedy Space Center, especially this past week, as Hollywood once again descended on the space coast to shoot some scenes from an upcoming movie, in this case, Transformers 3, The Dark of the Moon. It's been a long time since my three boys were young enough to play with Transformers, and I have to admit that I have not actually seen either of the first two movies, although my boys did when they came out, and had mixed reviews on the subject, by the way. In any case, the third film is in production for release next summer. And this past week at Kennedy Space Center, folks out there at the site reported seeing all sorts of things unusual that breaks up the normal workday. I guess they saw some Decepticons, and the star of the show, Optimus Prime, looked like a big semi-truck to me, but I guess it can transform into something pretty amazing. The big apparent revelation of the week in terms of the storyline that's getting all the buzz, even in the nation's Hollywood press, if you can believe it, was that it turns out that Space Shuttle Discovery, which is now at Pad 39A awaiting its final flight, is going to turn out to be a transformer when it arrives in orbit. So whether you're into this particular series of movies or not, I think this is going to be a must-see for us locally. I don't know if our friends at Delaware North and the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex working with NASA are already planning on some kind of a premiere. We'll have to wait and see what happens. But definitely something to look forward to seeing ourselves again up on the big screen here. I think, again, it's sometime next summer. Meanwhile, in the real world of spaceflight, the first ever all-digital upgraded Soyuz Russian spacecraft launched this past Thursday from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan with three crew members on board. They are scheduled to dock with the International Space Station today, in fact, tonight, at 7:10 p.m. Eastern Time. And I believe that NASA television will have that coverage on their network. Once the three crew members dock and climb aboard the station, the crew complement will be back up to six humans in space, six humans in space now. They'll be together. The crew that just launched, amongst the crew that just launched, included Scott Kelly, veteran space shuttle commander. And the interesting thing to note there that everyone's getting a kick out of is that if all the schedules hold, when Endeavour flies next February, Scott's twin brother Mark is going to be on board Endeavour as commander. And so amongst all the incredible space firsts that history will mark will be the first time that I think one of the Kelly brothers said the first time that flesh and blood relatives will be in space together. Certainly the first time identical twins will be in space together. And so that's kind of fun and neat, and it'll get some good play. And it's those kind of little things that even today I think still makes our space program interesting to those who aren't normally tuning in and think that NASA is just about going to the moon. And we know that's not the case. And that is definitely the subject for another conversation another day. By the way, speaking of the moon, China's second probe arrived at the moon this past week, and the chatter picked up again big time as people talked about China's plans to apparently land humans on the moon by 2017. I've heard different stories, but that was the chatter this week, that they expect to land their first people on the moon in 2017. You know, even if you are saying that they're just using modified Russian hardware and they really aren't doing anything new, they are on track, if you consider an Apollo-like schedule anyway, to doing it. And we're not. And what happens to our national space policy, both civilian and military, when the only language you hear from beyond Earth orbit is Chinese? Well, we'll all have to wait and see, of course. So let's see. Let's switch gears here a little bit also. In a moment, we are going to turn our attention to the topic of space tourism with the help of Derek Weber, a longtime space tourism advocate who now manages a consulting firm called Spaceport Associates. He is the author of a book about space tourism that was just published by Apogee Books in Canada. And so after we take a quick break, Derek is going to join us. In the meantime, if you want to join us for the program today and let us know your questions or comments, and I might even reward someone with your participation today, give us a call, 768-1240. 321 is the area code if you're listening beyond the Brevard broadcast area or online at WMMBAM.com. Local AT&T wireless customers, you can dial *1240 to reach us. And if you are listening online or just too shy to call in or whatever, send us some email to spacetalking@AOL.com. We'll have AOL pulled up here on the screen, and we'll get to your questions and comments that way. So in any case, space tourism is the topic when we come back in a moment. And this is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Our phone lines are open at 321-768-1240 for your questions and comments about anything having to do with the space program, or you can contact us via email. The address is spacetalking@aol.com. And throughout the week, by the way, you can also keep in touch with what we're doing by following us in a number of ways. There's Space Talk on Twitter. Our Twitter account is Space Talking, and you can visit the WMMB webpage, again, WMMBAM.com. And there you can download a recording of today's show. You can see what's going on with guests. There's links to past, for example, books that we've talked about on the air. You can purchase those and but just generally stay in touch with everything. By the way, we've also just recently finally figured out how to add a Space Talk page onto Facebook connected to my personal page. And if you happen to be on Facebook and go on the line there and search for Space Talk with Jim Behnke, you can bring up that page and appreciate the click that says like it, and you'll be counted among the friends of Space Talk. Our Twitter account is linked to that site as well, so you're going to see some cross-pollinization back and forth there. Our topic for the day is space tourism. Derek Weber, author of a new book called The Right Stuff, The Century of Effort Behind Your Ticket to Space, is supposed to be our guest today, and we're actually having a little trouble getting a hold of him right now. So as our chief engineer, Aaron Michaels, continues to work that problem, we're going to talk a little bit more about some other stuff that's going on. I mentioned in the opening this business about what's keeping people interested in the space program, and I wanted to share with you a little story. When I was in California a week ago visiting the Dryden Flight Research Center and the Ames Research Center, I had a nice conversation with a gentleman from the airplane trip from San Francisco back to, Atlanta. I guess you have to go through Atlanta to get to anywhere in the world if you're going to go from Florida to or from Florida. But on the way back, and he was a lawyer, specialized in some, I think it was some kind of health insurance area or whatever. Very smart, very articulate, had a couple of young children, young married guy, really was just, really a top end, high level guy that was just, again, a real pleasant, man to have a conversation with. And what was interesting to me about that conversation was that, as of course we get done talking about him, we start talking about me, and we talk about NASA and the space program. And of course, I got to ask him. I said, "What do you know about NASA? What do you think about NASA? What do you think about our space program?" And his comment was basically along the lines of, "Well, all I know about NASA is that they're the group that took us to the moon." And I was just floored. What about the space station? What about the space shuttle and its retirement? All that. He said, well, he knew about the space shuttle, wasn't very interested in it, never really heard a lot about it, acknowledged that maybe he thought that he had heard that the space shuttle was going to retire, didn't really know there was a space station up there right now. I told him, I said, look, there's, and I guess this was last week, so the guys hadn't come back yet. They had just come back. So the previous crew. So there were three guys on board the space station, the three that are up there now, in addition to the three that just launched, but back a week ago it was just the three. And I said, there's three guys up there right now, in space, working, living, playing, doing experiments, doing maintenance, doing everything it is that astronauts and cosmonauts do on board the space station. And he couldn't believe it. He didn't, it was like, well, I had no idea. And I said, look, the space station's actually been up there, in various states of assembly, for more than a decade now, nonstop occupied. And again, he didn't know this. He didn't know this. He only thought that NASA was the group that took us to the moon. By the way, which happened before he was born, being a younger guy that he was, and that he didn't know anything else about it. But he was interested in it. He was interested in space. He was interested in science. He was interested in exploration. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, this is a perfect example of the classic problem we all have in getting people and getting the support for our space program that we keep wanting for us. You know, you've got this intelligent guy connected to the world, well-read, well-educated, and yet completely lacking any kind of basic, you know, interest or in detailed information about the space program. You know, when I watch the game shows, and I've talked about this before, and I tease people about it. You know, when you watch the game shows, you just get, you know, your average contestant on the show. And, you know, I noticed that in the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire show, a lot of times the space program-related questions will be the highest-level stuff. So, you know, what's the story on that? They don't have the answers. And, you know, there's fairly easy questions, at least for me to answer, and I would suspect for a lot of you to answer, at least those of you part of the space program. And so that's okay. That's expected, you know. But this is a highly educated guy. So how do you do it? And he said, look, you know, I want to know what's in it for me. I mean, isn't that the classic answer? You know, what's in it for me? What is the kind and he didn't use the word spin-off, but what are the benefits? What if I knew more about what NASA did for me every day, if I knew how it applied to my life, you know, then I might show some more interest. And so naturally I get on the soapbox and I start telling them. And I start with my classic and favorite one, which is go into any major consumer electronics store, which, of course, Best Buy to me, being Minnesota-based, is the best one. And walk into Best Buy and look and see that practically 90%, if not more, of everything that's in that store comes directly from technology that was developed as part of our space program. You know, I mean, obviously the micro-miniaturized chips and our desktop computers, laptops and all that, the fact that the watch I'm wearing has more computing power in it than Apollo spacecraft did, was all the result of an effort in an industry to make things smaller, lighter, more powerful, faster, better, cheaper, okay, you know. But, you know, the Dell laptop that you might have in front of you didn't necessarily come directly from the space program, but its heritage did. And so the CD-ROMs, the DVDs, the ability to store massive amounts of data on a medium that can easily be accessed and stored without degradation of data, especially if you don't scratch the disks, which, you know, shame on you if you don't handle them correctly. Those things also came from the space program, came from a need from space where they said, look, we're going to go study a planet. We're going to go figure out how to measure this, that, and whatnot. And that's all this data is going to come streaming down, and we got to have a place to store it. I was sitting at Ames, and they showed me what they call the hyperwall. And the hyperwall itself, which we had another debate about how exciting it was, but it's essentially 128 television monitors, all kind of put in an array on the wall for people to look at. And the thing about the wall was that it wasn't so much that they had 128 TVs strung together for people to look at in this conference room. It was the fact that every one of those monitors was essentially the monitor, the connection, the visualizer for a major chunk of one of the supercomputers that NASA Ames has in its facility. And it shows, it can display in a visual sense, the data that is accumulated by these weather satellites. For example, they talked about how for about 5 years, around 2000, and I don't get these dates right, but in the 2001 to 2006 general time frame, they had an effort to record and put in a single database all of the data that all of the NASA Earth monitoring satellites were recording. So those that measured the temperature of the atmosphere and the air and the pressures and the highs and the lows, those satellites that were responsible for observing and recording the temperature of the water of the various oceans and the big lakes, the currents in the ocean, tracking those, the temperatures, the actual height of the sea level as it changes over the course of an ocean and over, around the whole world. Of course, the clouds and the usual weather data, and all of this information, all put together, all these different satellites that fed different studies and different scientific experiments, all put together in one big, giant, huge database, and then crunched together and then displayed as a global, as a single picture of the entire Earth, all there on that wall. And the things that they saw were incredible. Absolutely incredible. And how incredible were they? Well, we're going to have to come up here on our 5-minute break. I'll talk some more about it here as we continue to try to get a hold of our guest, Derek Weber. And again, we're having a problem with the phone apparently in his home in Washington. So when we come back from this 5-minute break, we'll touch base, see where we're at, continue to have our conversation here on Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Back in a few moments here, this is Jim Behnke on Space Talk, and you're listening to WMMB.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And indeed, welcome back to our second half of Space Talk. I'm Jim Behnke, and we are about to be joined here by Derek Weber, who we did get a hold of during the break, so thankfully everything worked out. But just to quickly finish this this story I was saying, this hyperwall at Ames crunched all this data about the planet Earth, and for over 5 years showed the planet alive, showed the weather patterns, the Gulf Stream, the ocean currents, the heat, the cold. To watch our hurricanes in 2004 go whipping by the state, major events in our lives that were just like little blips of data on the big planetary scale. And then, of course, a lot of attention on Katrina the following year. And they were able to take all that data and actually start comparing it to what the Hurricane Center uses and all the other models. And in Katrina's case, was actually able to predict 5 days before it hit New Orleans exactly what the path was. And afterwards, they matched it up, and it was exact. It was absolutely exact. I mean, it took all the error out of all of the other models. And the other models were able to learn from that. And, of course, there's still more study to be done before you go operational with that. NASA's not the live weather service, of course. They're sharing that data. So it was just really fascinating to see all that. Well, we're telling the guy in the airplane all about this stuff, and he's just the eyes are wide open. And again, it reinforced to me ultimately that, you know what, as hard as you try to get the public as a mass or group to understand and get excited, it almost does take that one-on-one effort, one person to one person, share the excitement, and that person tells someone, and so on. And so anyway, it was a fascinating eye-opener, again, a reminder of what we're all doing and how cool it is and how special it is that we're part of it all. Well, anyway, talking about flying in space and space tourism, of course, I've dreamed about doing this since I was a kid in Minnesota, you know, watching Apollo moonwalks on one channel and Star Trek reruns on another. A lot of people want to fly in space. A lot of people are interested in space tourism. There's all sorts of implications for us here on the Space Coast and the business and all that. So to help straighten out this topic and where we're at, we are going to talk to Derek Weber. He is a longtime advocate of space travel, space tourism. He's got experience working in the industry. He now runs his own consulting business on the topic called Spaceport Associates. And most importantly for today, he is the author of the book, The Right Stuff, The Century of Effort Behind Your Ticket to Space, published again by our good friends at Apogee Books in Canada. In this case, The Right Stuff, spelled W-R-I-G-H-T, as in the Wright Brothers. And Derek does join us on the phone from his home or his office in Bethesda, Maryland. Derek, finally, thank you, sir, for your patience. Welcome to Space Talk.
Okay. Hi, Jim, and to your Space Talk listeners also.
Great. Well, we're going to cover a lot here in the half hour that we've got left. Let's talk about space tourism in general. Is it for real, Derek? Is this a real thing?
It's for real. Obviously, the orbital version already exists. There's been 9 people have done orbital space tourism flights. Of course, they had to do it out of Russia. I'm hoping that eventually we can do it from the U.S. That would be great, but that hasn't started yet. But also, this whole new era of suborbital space tourism is about to begin. And that's, for the most part, what this book is about, getting ready for this new stage of space tourism, which is a suborbital, which is, in a sense, is a sort of a repeat of what Alan Shepard did all those years ago, a 15-minute flight into space and down again. You don't have to have the credentials that Alan Shepard had. All you need is $200,000.
Which seems like a lot to you and me, considering I have, you know, the boys in college and all that. But you know what? There are a lot of people that can afford that.
That's right. And it'll come down pretty quickly from that. That's the price that's being quoted by Virgin Galactic. And naturally, they're going to cream the market at the start, and people are willing to pay $200,000 to be, in a sense, pioneers of this new industry, to be among, you know, there's only been 500 people gone into space since the very beginning.
Right.
So a lot of these folks just want to be in the first 1,000, say.
You know, now space tourism, you bring that subject up a couple of years ago, and a lot of people around here anyway in the Space Coast just kind of, you know, shrug their shoulders and roll their eyes and say, yeah, right, sure. You know, and even today, I think there's a certain amount of embracing it, but yet there is still a certain kind of, you know, the conservative traditional aerospace industry. You know, are they embracing this now? Are they coming around?
Well, oddly enough, only fairly recently, a couple of the major companies have gotten involved. I mean, Boeing is now getting involved. Northrop Grumman bought up Bert Rutan's business.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of they're sneaking in, as it were. They were not advocates at the beginning, but they're realizing it's going to happen, and they're finding their own way of getting on board. Boeing is working with Bigelow, for instance. So and also with the success of the COTS program, which Johnson Space Flight Center has been operating in order to get new ways of getting up to the space station.
Mm-hmm.
My hope is that there's going to be some spare seats in those things once they get going, and once they start carrying American astronauts up to the space station, there'll be spare seats on board that tourists can use.
Yeah, and let's maybe we should step back a minute and talk about what space tourism is. You mentioned the orbital, you mentioned suborbital. We, a lot of times, like around here, like to say that even if you go visit the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, or heck, even take the Mission Space Ride at Epcot, you're participating in space tourism.
That's right, and that you know, there's a whole spectrum, and that's probably the cheapest end is you buy postage stamps with a space theme, and that's how I began back in the UK during the early days. I remember 1957, when Sputnik 1 went up, I was just a kid, and but once I learned there was a stamp, you know, got to get the Sputnik stamp, and you know, got my parents to take me a long way just to buy this one stamp. So that's how it began with me, and of course, I think most of your listeners all grew up with the excitement of the early space age, and I think the what I hope is that this space tourism is the next stage of that, and the excitement will come back because, let's face it, to a lot of people, you know, the excitement hasn't been there for a while.
Right.
I'm a volunteer docent at the Air and Space Museum at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.,
uh-huh.
And I'm kind of shocked at, you know, I take 20 or 30 people around from the general public every week. And some of the questions I get asked, you know, one realizes they haven't the foggiest idea of what space is or how it benefits. And I heard you just before I came on talking about this one-to-one is the real way to do it. And I agree. And I do that on my volunteer docent work. But I'm hoping that the book will get to a few more than one-to-one, and other people will see that this is kind of the next logical step, really, in the development of space. If you look at aviation, you know, the first aviators were took all the risks, but eventually you started flying passengers, and now any one of us can pay $150 and fly anywhere. And that's what happened over the time period. And I think we're waiting for that next stage in space flight to begin to happen.
Now, as you've, and I want to talk more about the book in a minute, but I do want to ask you this: as you survey the industry and the history and the policy and your own experiences, I do want you to comment on Florida, if you would. A lot of folks think we're either too little, too late, or we're not in it, or we're just getting in it. As you sit there up in the Beltway of Washington, what's your take on Florida's opportunities for space tourism in terms of suborbital and orbital?
Well, interestingly enough, I was at a meeting just about 2 days ago in the Beltway of a group called COMSTAC, which is a part of the Federal Aviation Authority, the part which is responsible for regulating commercial spaceflight. And they were talking about the possibility of hiring some of the guys who have been, up until now, have been working on space shuttle work, mm-hmm. operations work. And they're saying, there's going to be a change. We're going to have a lot of commercial space flight, and we need the expertise and the wisdom from those guys who've been running the program for years, mostly in the Kennedy area,
right,
to help this new industry get going. So I think you'll start finding some announcements about that pretty soon, that there's going to be they're trying to get the funding through right at the moment to hire a chunk of these people and then gradually expand on that, because they need people with operational experience to guide this new industry, because you can't afford to have failures, particularly failures early on.
Right. I mean, what happens when you lose? What's going to happen after you lose the first one? You know it's going to happen.
That's right. And at least I think the industry is wise enough to recognize that. So they're already doing a lot of work about that, how to react and how to deal with it. Because the idea is that it's really more like, it's not the same sort of thing as a Columbia,
right,
situation. These are not government astronauts. These are people who are doing risky things for their own pleasure.
Right.
And, obviously one would be sad if there's an accident or when there's an accident, but we don't want the whole industry to shut down for 3 years.
Right. And my biggest fear, Derek, is on the regulatory side. The government seems to be keeping an arm's length, let's kind of see what happens, trust in them kind of a thing, and then but when that first accident goes, the liability laws that have been passed are going to go away, and you're going to create much more of a bureaucracy in all of this, in much the way that the FAA has grown after every aviation incident in history. Well, look, stand by, Derek. We're going to take our last break here, come back, and continue talking about space tourism and Derek Weber's book. So stand by. We'll be right back. This is Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB.
This is Space Talk with Jim Banky.
Steak commercial sounded good. Well, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. My guest for just a few more moments, Derek Weber, author of the book The Right Stuff, The Century of Effort Behind Your Ticket to Space, published by Apogee Books. You can get that copy of that book, by the way, through the Space Talk page on WMMB. Just go to WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk, and you'll see the link there to Amazon. If you purchase the book through our page, not only do you support the author and the book and whatnot, but you also support Space Talk financially, and we would appreciate that. So, and also a link to Derek's website at Spaceport Associates we'll put up there later today as well. So, Mr. Weber, we just have a few minutes left, and again, I apologize for not missing you in that first segment, but let's keep going. The book is a very great overview. It looks like you wrote it in the sense that, let's say I'm a guy, I bought a ticket on Virgin Galactic. It sounds exciting, but I really don't know the history. I don't know how it all came about. And this book gives me that overview and that insight into that. Was that essentially what you were going for? Because that's certainly how I read it.
Well, I appreciate that. That's exactly what I was going for. There's a couple of special ideas I'm trying to get across. And one is that, Space tourism is a bit risky, but taking risks is American. And making money is American, and having fun is American. And, you know, this history tells you how it all began with the Wright brothers taking risks and so on, right up to the present day. So the last time I read the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness was in there as well.
Right.
and I think, you know, I might be 65, but I'm a young American. I became an American citizen just in the year 2000. So I have a lot of that feeling in me about one of the reasons I became an American was because this is where exciting things can happen and people are willing to take risks. So the government made it possible, you know, under George Bush, for this to happen,
yeah,
which was an extraordinary thing to do, to accept that people can kill themselves if they want. It's their right, but the government's responsibility is to make sure that nobody else who's uninvolved gets hurt,
right.
And that's where the regulations end. So that's kind of the way it's set up, and only this country could, I think, take that kind of a step. So I hope you're right that there's no possibility of going back on that. I thought it was kind of a courageous step for the country to take, and it enables a whole new industry to get going.
Well, and you named it the Wright stuff for the Wright brothers, and you give away in these books, in this book, sort of this fictional Wright stuff award, and can you talk about the award and really the reference to the Wright brothers themselves, why that's such a key part that it made it to the title of your book?
Okay, well, the funny thing is, when you know, it's partly because I'm a docent at the Air and Space Museum that I see the Wright flyer every week. 1903, that's when it flew. And the funny thing is, you find when you do your homework that 1903 was also the date when the Russian Tsiolkovsky wrote his first important paper about rocketry.
Mm-hmm.
And when I began to look into this, I found the sort of two parallel tracks of aviation and space going through the last 100 years, and then kind of rocket planes in the middle there. And it seemed to naturally lead to space tourism. So I sort of thought of the idea of making these awards and giving them to people who I think over the 100 years have made space tourism a possibility. And so I sort of said that, you know, what must they do to win this award? And I said it's, you know, they must have vision, they must have an acceptance of risk in order to achieve great things in the air and space. And they must, you know, it must be real. They must have a scientific and engineering appreciation of the laws of nature,
yeah,
and how to use them to advantage. But then also you need marketing and financial know-how. And then enthusiasm. You know, we're going to make a buck here. But also you need the supportive political environment. And that's why I have a whole section in the book about, you know, politics as well. So, and also there's a section about artists. They have helped to bring the vision to the public as well.
It just covers every area, and it's absolutely outstanding. And I recommend everyone picking it up and taking a look at it and to watch the story evolve through the years. It's going to be really great. Derek, we're actually running out of time. One quick last question. Are you saving up your money to fly yourself?
Well, if I don't do so, I hope my daughter gets a chance to do it.
Well,
I'd like to be there. I'm not so sure about getting there.
That's great. Well, sir, we're going to have you on again and make up for some lost time and ask some other questions. But thanks for being on with us today. And again, I appreciate you being here for us. So thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. And have fun on the Space Coast.
Great, thanks. Well, we want to remind everybody that the next planned launch from the Cape does appear right now to be Shuttle Discovery from the Kennedy Space Center. Discovery targeted to fly at 4:40 p.m. Eastern Time on November 1st, making its final trip into space and to the International Space Station. Later that same week, a Delta IV Heavy on a national reconnaissance mission has got the Eastern Range booked for November 5th, and Falcon 9's second flight from the company SpaceX targeted for November 8th. So we'll see how that all works out. By the way, there's some great opportunities this week to see the International Space Station fly overhead. I'm going to put the times up on the Space Talk webpage at WMMBAM.com. The best one's going to be Tuesday morning at 6:43. in the morning before sunrise. The station is going to be in the sky for about 3 minutes, flying from northwest to southeast, visible basically directly overhead. I got to tell you, though, I will not be watching for the station that morning, as I'm going to be asleep recovering from the Monday night football game between my Minnesota Vikings and the New York Jets, a game that's going to feature the fantasy football become reality football combination of Brett Favre passing to Randy Moss, who rejoined the Vikes this past week. I am so pumped up for this game. You cannot imagine. You'd think we were 2 days away from launching a space shuttle. I am that nervous and on edge about this thing. Well, anyway, next week on Space Talk, we're going to hear an update about what Space Florida is up to. Talk to some of the folks there and get an update on all things that they're working on, business development, education, spaceport operations, and whatnot. And we're going to talk about an event that is planned for next weekend, in which a memorial to workers who have lost their lives in the line of duty at the Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral Air Force Station is going to be dedicated. There have been several incidents through the years that don't get a lot of attention, and frankly, a lot of you may have never even heard about some of these. But it is a memorial that has been in the work for a long time. It is long overdue, and our friend Charlie Mars from the Space Walk of Fame up in Titusville is going to let us know all about that and what's going on with that. So I certainly do hope that you'll tune in for that. And again, we'll see what happens here in the next week or so. Thanks for joining us. That is it for today. Thanks again for listening. Space Talk is sponsored by United Space Alliance and is a production of Mylas Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer. The Home Mortgage Law Show is next here on WMMB. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Take care, everyone.